So I really love this as a beginning point, because when you if you show this to people, or you show a picture of a real virus, in my experience, 100% of the people will identify that as a virus. The article behind it is really good, but the reality, of course, the picture is hilarious. The picture's out of bad science fiction, and you've all seen these family pictures probably a few dozen times in the last couple weeks. But the points I want to make are, again, ones you've encountered a few times. Viruses are incredibly economical with their resources, their genome. And so they use a small gene, many copies of a small gene, to make a large envelope, a large capsid. And they're very free with our resources at the same time. And if they're too free with our resources, they're pathological. If they're a little more discreet, they get along with us fairly well. So you can have viruses that are fairly reasonable. So CCMV, for instance, causes no change in the growth of a plant, no change in the productivity of a plant, causes a little yellow spotting on the leaves, and the plants don't care. It's a well-adapted virus. But as a general rule, a virus capsid has a number of paradoxical requirements.
And is there any example of symbiosis where organisms live with a virus and benefit from its presence?
I can think of one really neat example. It's called LA virus. It's a virus of yeast. And it doesn't bud from the yeast, or it's not expelled from the yeast. It's passed mother to daughter. The virus produces two proteins. One protein is a pore-forming toxin that it secretes, and so if you have a high concentration of infected yeast, you have a high concentration of this toxin in the media. The other protein is retained in the cytoplasm, and it's a molecular plug. So if you have the virus, you plug the hole, and you have a huge selective advantage over yeast that don't have that particular virus. And
there are many, many examples. There are many bacterial viruses which integrate into the chromosome. Perhaps the best known of which is H-lambda. It encodes for a gene which confers resistance to killing by serum. And so it gives a very definite advantage to any pathogenic E. coli. I think I said yesterday that cholera is only the bacterium Vibrio cholera only causes disease when it harbors a bacterial virus.
But is that
is on the viral genome.
That's not a selective advantage, or I don't see it as a selective advantage.
That's a tremendous selective advantage, because now you suddenly provide this bacterium with a nice warm environment. It's in there, and it's going to flush itself out, having reproduced itself a large number of times.
Point. It spreads quite well at that point.
It spreads very well. And there are many such examples.
Thank you.
Symbiosis for the bacteria, not for the larger host. So these capsids have to assemble from a lot of small components, and that means they have to assemble with high fidelity, because if you have a virus that has the wrong size and shape, it's probably not going to be functional. It has to assemble on a biological time scale, which is, for this purpose, seconds to minutes. Has to assemble at the right time. If you form a capsid before you have the right components present, you don't have a virus, you have an empty shell. And if you form a capsid too late, well, it may be too late for to get a good infection.
When you speak about high fidelity, you just speak about that fidelity of the capsid formation, because people say that actually, for example, HIV, it's a virus that mutates extremely fast. So the fidelity of replication is not...
Well, HIV is a particularly interesting example. Only 1 out of 1,000 viruses is actually infectious.
Which one?
I'm asking you. I don't know, and nobody. I don't think anybody else does. So is it a function of 999 out of 1,000 somehow have a defect in their assembly.
It's on the verge of not being able to replicate itself. It's mutated so much.
Is it mutations or is it an error in the assembly? And it's not clear. If there's a defect in the assembly of hepatitis B virus, which I'll talk about a bit later, it's completely destructive. You don't have you completely ruin the viral life cycle. High fidelity is going to vary from system to system, but in most systems, you have pretty strict requirements for a minimum, and they're not incredibly tolerant of mutations. Some mutations will work fine, but a lot are completely destructive. And the last two points here are what I'm going to devote the first half of my 5 hours to. The first half. Huh? Thank you.
Finish that quickly.
I'm hoping. Capsids have to be stable because they have to, first off, they have to assemble. That implies stability. Second off, they have to be able to persist outside the host. That implies stability. Unfortunately, for a lot of viruses, they have to uncode at some point in their life cycle. Some viruses, the capsids stay around and the genome is expelled, but many viruses become unstable and release their genome in that manner. So instability has to be programmed in also. So just anticipate the talk, I'm going to spend about half the talk talking about stability and instability. And the other half I want to show some neat data, some neat results with hepatitis B and a small molecule that affects assembly in some interesting ways. So I had a really neat discussion with Chris this morning. And my summary of it is the perspective you take on how you study viruses is tremendously important. He was talking about the big picture being what are the physical principles that you can generalize through all viruses. And to a biologist, though, what the big picture is the organism. So the perspective you take is tremendously important in this. So why is it valuable to rigorously describe assembly? This is a slide that was written for virologists. If we have a great description of the assembly of a virus, and there's a gap somewhere between the behavior of that virus and its behavior in vivo, it suggests where there are going to be unknown host factors that are critical for assembly or disassembly. It also allows us to identify targets for antivirals, for interfering with either assembly, disassembly, or stability. And hopefully we can take advantage of assembly reactions and produce entirely new structures. So I'm not going to show any of it, but with CCMV, which is a spherical virus, we can divert assembly to form tubular structures now, just by providing the right scaffold to work with.
Sorry, part C there, I understood from what you said that you're preaching to the converted probably in this audience.
I don't know. I know your perspective is to look at, your idea of the big picture is what are the fundamental forces, but I think you also have to be sympathetic to the biologist's perspective. How is this going to relate to, how is this going to relate to the biological problems?
You show this slide to the virologists because they're not used to thinking this way, but in an audience here, which is more an audience of physicists, you probably ought to show a different slide to make us think differently than we usually think.
No, I'll just threaten you with my stick.
Okay.
So this may be the one you were looking for, Chris. Biologists tend to be obsessed with regulation in their systems. What are the proteins? What are the what's the timing? What are the steps in a cascade? Physics tends to produce. Where statistical effects tend to be relatively broad and really aren't tend to not be biological or not very biological looking. How do you tighten these things up? And the real advantage to regulation is you can take a reaction, uh, take seemingly unlinked reactions and put them together in one time and space. So here's my oversimplification of all of that. You can take one component of a complex system and understand all of the details, and that gives us a great picture of one component. And a physicist may have an incredibly, or we as a group may have an incredibly detailed view of assembly processes, like this detailed woodcut. Biologist view might be less detailed, but it's putting it into a larger picture, and this guy getting clubbed might be just one component of this Rube Goldberg. The points are, reductionism gives us salient factors without details, but it lets us concentrate on something that may not be as important or is only one component of a whole larger system. And at this point, I'm done preaching. We can go start looking at some data and how to take it apart. This is also a fun oversimplification. I'm going to just start off for the next few slides discussing application of law of mass action. So we're just going to have a constant is equal to capsid is equal to products over reactant. And this cartoon looks right, but it's actually wrong in some interesting ways. To biologists, I make the point that there's a pseudocritical concentration, a near constant concentration of free subunit, and there's a gap before you start seeing capsid appear. Where this is wrong is these really aren't sharp cutoffs. When you look here, what you see is that even at very low concentrations of input subunit, you should have a little bit of capsid when this reaction goes to equilibrium. But it may be so small as to be almost immeasurable. And when you're above this particular point, the concentration of free subunit will actually increase as you increase your total subunit. It's just that the vast majority of protein is going to go into the capsid rather than be available as free subunit. That's really why I call this a pseudocritical concentration rather than a concentration.
Is it going to be different from just simple mesylation?
I'm sorry?
Is it different from simple
micelle formation?
CMC, is there any biology in this? Or
if you realize that a CMC is just an approximation, is a constant that's an approximation for a number that actually does vary, there's no difference that between this and a CMC. In a chemistry lab, we tend to think of a CMC, it's a constant. But you take a look at something like Tanford's hydrophobic effect, he points out CMC shouldn't really be constant because this whole formulation says it's not. And it's really hard to imagine how... Well, I'll show you some data which do a nice job of describing this is not a sharp line. And that's over here. So this is Kalpi chlorotic model virus. You've heard about it more than a couple times. What we do is we take virus from plants, dissociate them, purify the dimers, purify the dimeric subunits by column chromatography, and then we reassemble them by shifting them into a high ionic strength, low pH buffer, in this case, pH 5. The reactions, we can watch the kinetics of the reaction, but I'm not going to be concerned with that. We're going to let this reaction go for 24 hours, and then we're going to put it onto a real nice HPLC with an auto-injector, so it's remarkably standardized. And here's an example of some of that size exclusion data. Oh, the column is a Supro 6 column for what it's worth. You see a capsid peak, you see a dimer peak. The void volume is right about over here, so everything's included. The dimer peak is nearly constant, though that's not particularly clear here, and you can see how much the capsid peak changes. When you look at it over a very broad range of concentrations, even at the lower concentrations here, we were able to see a certain amount of capsid appearing, but above about 3.5 micromolar input protein, almost all additional proteins seem to go into capsid. The dimer concentration doesn't go up and then level off. There's a certain amount of curvature visible. So we're getting something that looks very much like we'd predict. In fact, it looks exactly like what we'd predict. And a sad truth is if I didn't know this was forming 90 dimer capsids, I couldn't tell it from 60 dimer capsids or 40 dimer capsids. This power law is just too huge. But knowing that it's 90 dimer capsids, and knowing that each dimer can roughly be stated to have four protein-protein interactions, and with CCNV that's a very poor approximation, you wind up with a pairwise interaction energy on the order of about 6 kT for this system.
Isn't the width of the transition dependent on this power?
I'm sorry?
The how sharp the transition depends on this power?
Yes, it should, but it's not going to be... We just don't have the sensitivity to pick it out. And really, the best way to pick that out would be the slope of this line here, but you tell me how I'm going to pick out a very small change in slope.
Sorry, Adam.
Sure.
You're not happy with our thinking about that as essentially leveling off?
I'm stuck with thinking of this as leveling off. Okay. I know that theoretically it's a slight slope. I'd love to be able to... I don't know how I can get data better than this. And given just this concentration of free dimer, I can do a pretty fair job of estimating the association energy, and I can calculate a line like that, the line there, which is ideal. So.
How do I know that this is equilibrium?
It's a fun question. There's two parts to that problem. Has a reaction, well, if it wasn't at equilibrium, I would expect that this is taken at 24 hours. We also have tested this system at 48, 72, and 120 hours. And the concentration of dimer doesn't change. Does that mean it's at equilibrium or stalled? And for right now, I'm going to just ask you to accept that I think it's at equilibrium, and I'll show you some simulations that would support that. And I'll try to take these apart and also examine the same problem.
You can't both ways in the situation, and you go along the same curve if you wait long enough?
I'm going to spend a fair bit of time discussing that exact problem. If you try going backwards, you have a huge hysteresis to dissociation. If you go for to steal the punchline, and I know you guys love a mystery, but I'll ruin it anyway. To steal my punchline, the Ford reaction really does come close to equilibrium, and it comes close to equilibrium pretty fast. The reverse reaction is there's a huge hysteresis to dissociation, and so the reverse reaction is extraordinarily slow, and that's largely a function of the closure of the capsid. Pulling one subunit out involves breaking many bonds all at the same time, and so it creates a huge energetic barrier.
So I have a dumb question. What does equilibrium mean in this? Do you mean that it's achieved a steady state which has detailed balance where the number...
Microscopically, yes. Exactly. It's just classical equilibrium. You have microscopic equilibrium between every microscopic reaction, and the concentration of assemble of a freeze dimer in assembled capsid is what you would predict from an input from input value.
To establish that state are shorter than the time of your experiment.
The transients, meaning the intermediates, or
meaning initially the rate to go this way is not the rate to go that way, mm-hmm. because you haven't made the other product
well
yet.
Initially, because I have the reaction tweaked in one direction. Okay, so that was CCNV. I think of CCNV as a more complicated system because kinetically it's a pain in the neck. It has a lot of intermediates that are persistent during assembly. I'm not going to go into that. Hepatitis B is my favorite system. It's simpler kinetically, but it's also much more fundable. And it's been, and we have many fewer experimental artifacts associated with it as well. It's not as sticky a protein to work with. So with hepatitis B, we express the protein in E. coli, purify dimers again, And dimers tend to be stable at low ionic strength at neutral pH. We can induce assembly by raising ionic strength. And again, we give these reactions about 24 hours to equilibrate. The data here are a little noisier, in part because we were using a simpler chromatography system, but these are again size exclusion data. At 0.3 molar sodium chloride, pretty much above 4 micromolar protein, pretty much 4 micromolar is that pseudocritical concentration for assembly, and anything above that goes into capsid. At 0.5 molar sodium chloride, the pseudocritical concentration drops to about 2 micromolar, and at 0.7, drops below 1 micromolar. This is kind of neat behavior.
And if yeah. I remember correctly, you actually had to engineer a little bit these proteins. Ah. Like
so, okay. Yes, where we're using just the assembly domain of Hep B. The whole full protein is 183 residues long. We've lopped off the last 34 residues, which are an RNA binding domain. That RNA binding domain isn't involved in capsid assembly. And we finally figured out how to take apart the protein containing it. So this is just a truncated form of the protein in that regard.
It doesn't affect the end product, maybe, in terms, but it may affect kinetics.
It certainly is going to. I would be surprised if it didn't. However, well, brand shiny new data that we haven't had a time to reproduce. If we take the purified full-length protein, which was a major, I think, a big accomplishment to purify, add nucleic acid to it, it assembles into virus-like particles very nicely. In the presence of nucleic acid, the assembly is incredibly quick. We haven't looked at it in the absence yet.
How do we know that the final product is not a very
effective? By size exclusion chromatography, it comes out at 4 megadaltons. By electron microscopy, it is at low resolution, but by transmission electron microscopy, it's about a 340 angstrom diameter spherical particle. If you take a look at these empty particles in image reconstructions, they're indistinguishable from intact viral capsids, infectious viral capsids. So I'm pretty happy with them as a good model system.
And the full protein doesn't assemble into empty capsids?
I'm sorry?
The full protein does not assemble into empty
capsids? It does assemble into empty capsids in a really hot infection. You do see some empty capsids, some fairly old work by Linda Stannard, who collected virus particles from human kidneys.
How about in vitro?
In vitro, I don't think anyone has really looked at it. When this thing is expressed in E. coli, it assembles into empty capsids in E. coli. And if you express this in cultured mammalian cells, it assembles into empty particles, provided you don't have that C-terminal extension. So it's a nice assembly system, well-behaved in a lot of ways.
If you increase the sodium chloride?
Huh?
You increase it beyond 0.7 molar?
Fun question. Up to about 1 molar, we get capsids. We go beyond there, and we start getting kinetic traps. And that's a function of probably having very strong protein-protein interactions, starting assembly at many points, and having a lot of partially complete capsids. And then these partials, if we look at them early and run them over a size exclusion column, we see partly assembled capsids. If we let them sit around, they aggregate and fall out of solution, and sort of looks like one of those snow globes on a small and expensive scale.
In GPC, it's obviously you can distinguish small parts of the capsid, but once it gets close to half full, can you actually pick up any difference between half formed
and a fully formed, yeah, but three quarters and fully, probably not. What we do in certain cases, is use a multi-angle light scattering detector. So the same instrument that David was using, except he was doing hard experiments with the machine, for batch experiments, where you took a sample and put it into the machine. We just have a flow cell in there, so our column filters out all the dust to start with. But in that way, we can judge the molecular weight as something comes off the column, and it's so plus minus 5%.
This fixed concentration, right? You're not diluting. Typically, what you can see is the dilute stuff.
Oh, yes, it becomes tremendously diluted.
So when it gets diluted, it flows slow enough that nothing changes?
Yes and no. Capsid doesn't change. Once it's assembled into capsid, it doesn't change. Oligomers do change during elution. They fall apart during, but they don't fall all the way apart, or at least not all of them fall all the way apart. We can see examples of that in cases where we've accelerated assembly using small molecules.
So the fact that you don't seem to meet it, is it part of the analysis, or is it something that
the fact that we don't see intermediates at long times is implied by kinetic simulations or predicted by kinetic simulations. We don't see intermediates at long times in successful reactions. The only times we do see intermediates are at very early times in an assembly reaction. There's another point to be made here. So let's get away from gel permeation chromatography or size exclusion chromatography, which we have a big problem with saying whether or not there's intermediates. Light scattering is sensitive to weight average molecular weight, which means if we have small intermediates present, they're going to be flooded by their signal's going to be swamped by the larger intermediate. When HEP-B assembles, we have about a twofold change in fluorescence. During assembly, intrinsic protein fluorescence. Now that's going to be sensitive to the individual protein molecules involved in assembly. So it's really equivalent to number average molecular weight, or it's proportional to number average molecular weight. If we had a lot of intermediates present, we would expect to see a divergence between the fluorescence and under some situations like this, we would expect to see a divergence between the fluorescence experiment, the fluorescence signal, and the light scattering signal. If we have a very small concentration of intermediates, the two signals should be superimposable, and that's the case. Now, under conditions where we have kinetic traps and lots of schmutz accumulating during the reaction, we see a difference.
Adam, just in some units that we can think about, what should we think about concentration?
This is in micromolar.
Oh, okay. You're treating them as
And it's in terms of dimer, micromolar dimer.
The other thing is, it's hard to go back and forth, of course, with dilution of the whole system. But if one were to make a prep at 0.7 molar of sodium chloride and then go to 0.3 molar of sodium chloride, does it come apart easily then?
Nope. Slow as hell.
It's still slow. Okay.
Incredibly slow.
And ditto with pH shift? Reversibility to answer some of these questions.
Well, I'm going to bang on reversibility in around six slides in great detail. But a couple points to be made here. With HEP-B, unlike CCMV, the protein-protein interactions, quasi-equivalence, is really tremendously maintained. And each protein can be thought of as a rectangle that interacts at the corner. So we have four protein-protein interactions. And we're going from about, in this case, about minus 5.5 kT per contact over here to about minus 7 kT per contact over here. Very weak interactions. But it's actually tunable. based on temperature dependence, we know we have a positive enthalpy of interaction, of association, positive entropy of interaction. So that's very consistent with the hydrophobic effect. When we look at the structure of this, we see that almost the entire buried surface is hydrophobic. It's actually much more hydrophobic per area than you see in most protein-protein interactions. So it's really nice and that our thermodynamics is consistent with that. The ionic strength dependence still remains a puzzle. It suggests that we have that we have some sort of collection of charges that are being relaxed that at higher ionic strength and allowing association. What I suspect is that this effect is happening prior to assembly. So we're going from an assembly inactive state to an assembly active state, and that the higher ionic strength is destabilizing the inactive state.
If you try really hard not to think, and you just did something by rote, like taking the association constant as a derivative in respect to the salt concentration, mm-hmm. What kind of numbers of salts would you infer coming in and out?
I haven't done that.
And I say you have to try not to think it's constantly holding.
So, Paul, you've played games with this as well.
Extraordinary change in your activity.
Question. Is it shouldn't be a relation between the slope of the calcium concentration, the function of the
Chris, if you don't, it's labeled. It says the concentration of calcium 149.
Shut up! I'm asking him. I'm asking you.
Okay, go. So
you're saying the slope should be 1/120.
Right. So can you measure it?
No.
Why not?
Lack of experiment. It's an experimental problem. If you do the log of this, the log plot, you're just you can't possibly tell 120. We just don't have that
no,
sort of accuracy.
He's not asking for the F1. He's asking can you measure the number
of concentration? Hey. I'm asking the question, not you. Okay. Don't tell me what I'm asking. Okay.
Okay.
I'm asking what he's answering here. Why can't you measure the number of the dimers in the passive? Because you cannot measure the concentration.
I'm sorry. From here I can measure the amount of dimers. What I can't do is I can't measure this slope with incredible accuracy because you can see what the experimental noise is like. And this slope, I can say every bit of additional protein is going into it. The thing is, I would have to have an accuracy of better than 1% over here to get that 120th relationship. Am I answering your question? I'm basically saying that experimentally we can't pull these numbers out perfectly.
Perhaps look at here later.
So, on to a new system. This came out in the paper version about a month ago. It's bacteriophage P22. It's one of the perversities of nature that bacteriophages in general are more complicated than mammalian viruses in general. It's not a perfect generalization, especially if you look at herpes or pox viruses, but it's not a bad one. Bacteriophage P22 assembles procapsids when you mix the capsid protein and the scaffold protein together. Too high a concentration of capsid protein and you assemble curlicues and all sorts of strange things. Too low a concentration and you don't get assembly at all. You have a very narrow range you can work in. So this work is actually done in Carol Teschke's lab at University of Connecticut. And because scaffold is present, we have a somewhat more complicated expression here. There's always 420 capsid proteins here, but the concentration of scaffold in a given capsid is going to depend on how much we input up to saturation. And what you see is the more scaffold you have, the more assembly you get. The more scaffold you have, the less free capsid protein monomer you have present. And so again, you see the same story repeated. And it's kind of nice that this is covering things across the board. This winds up being a much more difficult set of experiments, or a much dirtier set of experiments, because first you have to assemble capsids, then you have to assemble products from reactants, Then you have to figure out how much scaffold is in the capsid and how much capsid protein and scaffold you have in each pool. And that's done by SDS page.
At the end, the scaffold is still present in the procapsid.
Yes. You can actually wash the scaffold out of procapsid, and the procapsids persist. And that goes to this whole thing of a great deal of hysteresis to dissociation.
Could you just tell us what the error bars are? So, I mean, this seems like forced intellectualization.
These are hand-drawn lines. The error bars. Well, let me do a better job than that. Let me show you a large collection of data, and these are individual data points. So that those were basically three individual experiments, but any interpretation is going to be based on this sort of an effect. We're just taking the amount of scaffold in solution, the amount of capsid in solution, and the amount of procapsid formed, and calculating a K-capsid for it, and from that getting a delta G procapsid, which is a humongous number.
Well, and the delta G is what we see. You're putting delta G as being log of K?
RT log of K, and this is in K cals.
There is a unit in K. It's 1 over concentration to the power.
That's standard chemistry.
That's not the real energy of the delta G of real bond formation.
No, this is for formation of a whole capsid, it's for formation of many bonds.
Yeah, and because of the unit, there is a unit in K.
So we could parse this out the same way we've done before and come out with the pairwise interaction energy, which is a much more reasonable value. In fact, it comes out to about -6, -7 kcals per protein, not per interaction, for both the capsid protein and for the scaffold.
The delta G is with respect to a standard state, and that takes the inputs out. Right?
Yes.
So it's really a ratio.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You're right, though, the equilibrium constant is in bizarre units. You know, molar to the -420th power is a little.
Right. But if you make zero there and worked up from that zero, it's a wow anyway.
Yeah.
Is there not much scaffolding protein around in real life?
In real life, it's very, very closely regulated, and it tends to get reused because when the virus matures, it ejects the scaffold protein. If you have too much scaffold protein, you have kinetic traps. You get a lot of starting points, and things don't finish. If you overexpress scaffold protein in vivo, you have less virus in the end. So too much stability is a bad thing. Not enough, and you don't get any assembly. The point here is that as a function of scaffold protein, we're making more stable capsids. And it's a little complicated trying to draw the previous graphs because each point you have a different amount of scaffold present. Right. So.
Could you just give an idea, for instance, what volume you're filling percent of the capsid? On this graph. Is this close to filling it?
No, it's nowhere as close to filling it. It's coating the inside. This is about a 400 angstrom diameter capsid, and we're just making it. One of the fun problems with this is that no one has really done a decent job of visualizing exactly how the scaffold binds, but it's a small protein.
Corresponds to coating the interior.
And so we're doing less than doubling the thickness of the capsid. So we're going from, say, 50 to maybe 70 angstroms thick.
That's the ballpark. So linear could be just the scaffold capsid protein contact.
Yeah.
So can I draw from this graph the conclusion that there is no cooperativity between scaffold proteins? So scaffold proteins act individually because it's a straight line, without helping each other, there is no aggregation in that sense?
Yeah. And the best idea is that if you have two capsid proteins like this, you have one scaffold protein hooking two of them together. It's probably scaffold protein likes to form dimers, and it binds primarily through electrostatic interactions, probably to two individual capsid proteins.
That's stable.
But not just a little better than a staple, because it's also providing the information to contain the radius of curvature, constrained it.
if you change the scaffold protein, you might change the D number or the curvature of the shell.
That's an interesting idea. There have been games played with changing T number, but I think that's without scaffold present. But yeah, conceptually, yeah, that would be an interesting way to do it.
And to finish, again, the scaffold molecule is about 5 kT. How much should we keep from the slope?
Okay, per protein, it's 10 kT. So if you say two interactions, 5 kT per interaction.
So what's the in vivo level of scaffolding?
I'm afraid I don't know, Ian. For some reason, I have the idea that it's somewhere in the middle here, but I don't know that anybody knows exactly. And part of it is that there seems to be heterogeneity in capsids, in the amount of scaffolds per capsid. So, the nice thing. One of the things this says is that suggests that these are reactions reaching equilibrium. If they weren't reaching equilibrium, first off, the height of that concentration of free dimer would change over time, and we've tested that, it doesn't. Second off, it would have to, any time you stop a reaction early, the concentration of free dimer winds up having a pretty significant and observable slope, and that just levels off over time. So this implies these reactions are reaching equilibrium, and I'm going to hit on that more in a little bit. You get this nice pseudocritical concentration, and of course K-caps, it can be decomposed into component energies per subunit, per protein, per interaction. And you have to do this with a great deal of caution, because sometimes when you look at capsid proteins in structures, you have one capsid protein interacting with up to half a dozen other capsid proteins. So it has to be done with a grain of salt. The one nice thing is when you look at those per interaction, per pairwise interaction energies, you're getting really weak interactions, but we're winding up with globally stable capsids. 5 kT interactions, but we're getting assembly in micromolar protein concentrations. And a lot of that is because all of our proteins are multivalent. So some nice biological implications, and this is something that was put in because I think biologists need to understand that this has relevance to biology, but it's appropriate here because it's important to connect physics back to biology. If we have an excess of capsid protein accumulating in vivo, we will get empty capsids. You do see that in some cases. But it's not to the virus's advantage in a lot of cases, and so it suggests that this is an opportunity to regulate assembly. So we don't get a lot of empty capsids and we get efficient packaging of the viral nucleic acid and other proteins. And one way of handling that is allostery, switching from an inactive to an active conformation. And it's nice, the previous three examples I showed you were reactions that were well behaved and really reached equilibrium. So it's nice to see what a reaction that stinks looks like. So this is CCMV N delta 34. I like to whack the ends off of viral proteins, one end or the other. N delta 34 was discovered when I did a sloppy job purifying the capsid protein and didn't put protease inhibitors in. Proteases clipped off the N-terminal 34 residues, and suddenly we got a very odd form of assembly. When we ran N-delta 34, and it's been now expressed genetically, but in yeast, but N-delta 34 size exclusion trace looks like this. We have a broadening of a major peak over here. We clearly have a shoulder over here, and we still have some dimer left over. Well, the shoulder turns out to be TQL1 capsids. This is made out of 30 dimers. And the larger peak is really a mixture of TQL3 capsids made of 90 dimers and these bizarre guys made out of 60 dimers. In studies of the kinetics of assembly, it seems that the first thing that assembles is a pentamer of dimers. So you have these creatures that essentially look like that. These assemble early on very rapidly, and we can trap them by size exclusion chromatography, but not in great quantity. And the limiting step in assembly seems to be adding one dimer across here. If we force an assembly reaction so that we have a huge number of these pentamers and very little free dimer left, we get these guys, which are really pentamers of dimers that have interdigitated. And the interdigitation is a wholly novel bond. And when you examine these closely, you don't actually have just a homogeneous population of these 60 dimer capsids. They come in a range of sizes from about 21 to about 25 angstroms in diameter. So they seem to actually scissor around. They don't have a real nice, neat minimum. When you assemble them, give them a day to, when you assemble them initially and watch the kinetics, it's indistinguishable from wild type kinetics based on light scattering studies. Give them a day to assemble, and you see that the dimer curve looks about like this, a fair degree of tilt. Check them out 2 days later. This is at 72 hours, and you still have the dimer concentration has not leveled off. You give it another 2 days, and the dimer concentration is still smaller. And each time you see more capsid, primarily in this larger peak. So this is a reaction that A, hasn't reached equilibrium by the two tests we have readily available. We don't have that pseudocritical concentration, and the dimer concentration is itself not stable. And it's not too surprising. What we have here is a sort of a kinetic trap. We have our dimer peak includes pentamers of dimers as well as dimers, and these guys are gradually assembling into this, which is just a way of removing these pentamers of dimers from the solution. It is itself a kinetic trap.
So you can't separate pentamers from dimers in the first
place? You can, under the right conditions, you can see a slight shoulder over here. If we have a very nice, well-behaved reaction for forming T=3 capsids, and we inject it into a column at about 5 minutes, right after you've had a big bolus of pentamer of dimer formed, what you see is a peak and then a very slight shoulder. And based on a multi-angle light scattering, the trailing edge of that shoulder comes out at 200 kilodaltons, a pentamer of 40 kilodalton proteins.
So, Adam, are you actually suggesting here that if you would put one or more, let's say, random mutations or change things in the proteins, that you might not reach from an equilibrium the law of mass action that apply, you keep on evolving? Are you suggesting actually that viral proteins are very specially engineered that will reach thermal equilibrium, but if you mess them up, this is a typical case, you end up with junk?
I can say absolutely that in 3 out of the 3 cases I've tested, they reach equilibrium.
Three out of the three
cases I've tested without mutations, they reach equilibrium. With Hep B, we've looked at a number of mutants, and they all reach. We put in a number of mutations. One of them does not reach equilibrium.
There's a critical concentration of mutations where typically you will no longer reach because you've messed up the structure of the protein from its shape.
There is a notion called a notion that if you you can have a catastrophic number of mutations. That a catastrophic number of mutations is required to kill a virus.
Right?
Yep.
So you're talking about,
but there are some real problems with that particular idea, because some mutations, some point mutations, are completely fatal, and others are completely innocuous. And
That's why there's a limited number of critical.
And some mutations are actually to the advantage of the virus under certain circumstances. For instance, F97L with Hep B accelerates assembly and makes a more stable capsid, and it does reach equilibrium.
Can you say what from the excision for the N delta 34, what part of the protein is?
Okay, with N delta 34, we removed the RNA binding region, and we've removed the part that's responsible for forming a beta hexamer underneath the quasi sixfold. However, if we just remove the beta hexamer, it still forms nice behaved, well behaved T-equal 3 capsids and looks.
That's not the reason.
Yeah. I think what's happening here is somehow we've accelerated formation of these pentamers of dimers, and we've decreased the barrier to having them aggregate. So we've actually, my guess, and this is only a guess, is we've lowered the barrier to an alternative pathway that's trapping intermediates.
These are full capsids.
These are empties.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the fact that you don't have the RNA binding site shouldn't.
Presumably not. The RNA binding site should presumably is not involved in any protein-protein interactions. I'm sorry. Not particularly. If these guys are pretty well behaved, so long as you have the pH low. That RNA and that RNA binding site still has a +9 charge at low pH.
I want to ask you about this picture in the middle. Do you really know that this what you call kinetic traps look like these nice finished balls, although different ones than you?
Right. So the,
maybe it's some trash with overlapping pieces.
Okay. So our reclamation, the amount of protein that's input is input onto the column is pretty good, or the recovery of protein injected onto the column is pretty good, and it's really just in these two broad peaks. So we don't have a lot of large aggregate. This over here, I really. It's not just an aggregate, it's not a uniform aggregate of pentamers. In fact, 90% of them don't look exactly like this. This is an image reconstruction. They come in a variety of sizes, and they are not particularly well behaved.
So how was that image reconstruction done?
Painfully. It's a 20.
Nice, pretty picture there.
Ah, right. So what was done was. Capsids were assembled, and then this peak was shaved off. Jinghua Tang and Jack Johnson's lab took a huge number of particles and sorted them based on size. One narrow size range yielded decent reconstructions. Other size ranges yielded reconstructions that were at very low resolution and were, it was hard to have, they were too unstable. You could add a few additional capsids into the reconstruction and the reconstruction would change dramatically. That said, some of the reconstructions appeared to have clockwise interactions between these pentamers and dimers, and others seemed to have counterclockwise interactions between them. So there was a great deal of heterogeneity, and it's just, at this time, it was very hard to characterize.
But in a size-limited group, you were imposing symmetry.
Symmetry was imposed, but if you've ever seen a so two things. So the image reconstruction at this 20 to 24 angstrom resolution provides a nice envelope, but you don't get molecular detail. But for this form, for the T-equal 3 and the T-equal 1, it was very easy to take a pentamer of dimers out of the crystal structure and dock them into that envelope. For the T-equal 3 it was docked without any change at all. For the T equal 1, this is built of dimers, the dimer interface changed moderately. The angle between dimers shifted somewhere in the ballpark of 7 degrees. If you tried to take one of these pentamers of dimers and fit them in here, it doesn't work very well. The only way to fit it in is you actually have to shift all of these subunits a few degrees around. So they're actually, the envelope is good enough that you can see the height is right, but the connections between them are wrong. So it's a tight enough envelope for that. We are imposing icosahedral symmetry in the reconstruction. Really, Jinghua Tang imposed icosahedral symmetry in these reconstructions. But if you've ever seen a reconstruction where icosahedral symmetry was imposed wrong, what tends to happen is features smooth out, and in the extreme, you wind up with golf ball-like particles. So the reason 90% of the particles were thrown out during this reconstruction was to produce something that was reliable, though not representative of the other 90%. Sad to say. Okay, so we see things assemble. It's nice to say they go to equilibrium, and I've been saying that over and over, and I'm sure I haven't convinced you unless you already started off convinced of that. So the great way to see that you've gone to equilibrium, if you're doing a simple reaction, is that you can start with pure reactant.
Adam, you're about 1/6 through your presentation.
Somewhere's about a little bit more than 1/3.
Okay, because it is sort of, you choose a time for a break.
You decide.
Okay.
This is a good time to stop. You want to go on a little bit.
So what I want to do is discuss hysteresis in about 5 slides, and then I want to talk about HAP1. So we can either go on for 5 slides. Okay. So real simple. You can start with reactants or products come to the same equilibrium, and that works for simple reactions. But any reaction, I would say that any reaction within the ballpark of 100 steps fails to be simple. So this is Adrian's experiment. He wants me to take capsid assembled under one set of conditions and dilute it. And so I cleverly did it before he asked me to. So what we did here is we took capsids that were, we took assembled capsids, diluted them into 150 millimolar sodium chloride and watched them fall apart. Based on assembly studies, we should have a curve that looks exactly like this. The pseudocritical concentration for assembly is right around 15 micromolar protein. Now we took purified capsids, put them in 150 millimolar sodium chloride, and these are sitting on the bench at room temperature, and we waited 5 days, and then we injected them onto a column, and we found we had capsids left over. And this is actually, the points here are the real data, and the curve is drawn by hand rather than fitting anything. These points here where we seem to have a great loss of capsid should be taken with a grain of salt because we're dealing with incredibly low concentrations of protein to the point where we're limited on detection. But what we see here is a wonderful hysteresis. Assembly is about 80% complete in just 2 hours, so this has had a long time to fall apart, and not much has happened. Now, another way of taking something apart, if you're studying proteins, the way to take to dissociate a protein is to use denaturant. So we took purified capsids and used guanidine hydrochloride and studied their denaturation. We used intrinsic protein fluorescence. We used light scattering. We used size exclusion chromatography. And beyond 3.5 molar guanidine HCl, we're actually unfolding the proteins, which is and we can't go backwards from that. But up to this point, we have intact protein based on circular dichroism, and we can take protein here and assemble it with high efficiency. But what you see is all three measurements here, in this subject of functional quaternary structure, a function of weight average molecular weight, and the amount of, actual amount of capsids we have, everything falls pretty much on the same line, though it's a little noisy. And if we extrapolate this to zero guanidine HCl, we come up with a contact energy that's much stronger than we had based on assembly studies. So instead of minus 5 kT, we are seeing something in the ballpark of 10 kT. We're dissociating down to dimers. We can purify those, and even in 3 molar guanidine HCl by CD, everything is intact.
Is this dependent on waiting time? Is there any change if you wait longer and longer, or it just sits there?
Oh, if we wait longer, at shorter times, this curve was marginally higher, but I'm never sure whether or not that was data noise or real.
So, three different methods give you a reassuring consistency, but I'm trying to understand. You're saying when you change the quantity, you might put this is starting from the assembled.
We start off with assembled capsids.
And it goes back to a. But it is still its hysteretic.
Yes.
Okay.
So we're starting with pure capsids over, and then adding guanidine.
Right.
If, on the other hand, we start off with pure dimer and have a little bit of guanidine and add salt,
So
nothing happens. Actually, we do that with urea because it's no ionic strength.
Just simply not going back to where it's supposed to.
Yep.
How long have you been?
120 hours was basically a long weekend. Okay, so we see hysteresis and dissociation, and we're not the only ones. It's been seen with bacteriophage R17, and in fact, Gregorio Weber observed that pretty much any biological oligomer of defined size, larger than a tetramer, had a good chance of showing hysteresis. And bacteriophage P22 also shows a great deal of hysteresis, even without scaffold. So, number of sources for hysteresis. Most obvious one is we're in some sort of kinetic. We have a kinetic trap of some sort, a kinetic barrier to dissociation. And so, you guys have seen this probably as many times in the past few days as I've seen it. But basically, a simple model of assembly, add one subunit at a time, each contact scores one unit of energy. If we let this reaction go for based on the actual number of contacts, we can calculate this sort of a curve, and allowing the reaction to go for an arbitrary amount of time, it quickly is able to recapitulate an equilibrium assembly curve where we have mass fraction of capsid and the concentration of dimer here. We have that pseudocritical concentration again. If we take this cascade of reactions and apply the same microscopic forward rate across the board, or a slower rate for these earlier ones and a constant rate for the later ones, include statistical factors, calculate a backward rate from the number of bonds that have to get broken, we can come up with these really nice, neat kinetic simulations. You see monomer concentration falling, and what you see is that each intermediate appears, accumulates, and then settles down to steady state. So you have this nice sort of cascade of intermediates appearing, and since you can't get 12-mer without some 11-mer, you have a lag phase. And in this case, we actually have things are pretty flat, but if you took a look at this close-up, you'd see it would not match what David saw with HPV. Its lag phase is going up almost constantly before capsid really takes off and starts accumulating. So we have a nice, neat assembly reaction, and it actually looks like a hepatitis B assembly reaction or a P22 assembly reaction.
What was the little red curve again?
Oh, dimer trimer. In fact, you can just, based on where the peak is, you can figure out where each one appears.
It's not equilibrium.
Yeah. This is, each of these is a reversible reaction. At this point, it's not at equilibrium. But you know what's surprising? If you look at this, the microscopic reactions really are very close to equilibrium all through here. And they're relaxing to a true steady state. At very, very long times, the concentrations of intermediates is extraordinarily low. So I know this was a topic of discussion. This guy here is really not much lower than any of the other guys. But the important point is that in these earlier stages of the reaction, these guys approach appreciable concentrations, concentrations that are high enough to allow the reaction to proceed forward. And you always have a high concentration of monomer present to react with. So what's fun is you can then take that same set of that same simulation, and instead of starting off with pure monomer, start off with pure capsid. Allow the reaction to go for a while, wait till it seems to level off, an arbitrary time, and then see how much capsid you have left. Well, for an association reaction, based on the amount of contact energy and also based on kinetic simulations, you see with 2 micromolar, a total of 2 micromolar monomer, the amount of capsid you get starts accumulating just at -3 kcals and goes on up. For dissociation, you actually have to catastrophically lower the association energy before you start seeing these guys fall apart. So we have a nice, neat little problem. And so this is just a function of this, presumably something built into the simulation. This is a real recent paper where they did coarse grain MD simulations and were essentially able to recapitulate this difference between association and dissociation reactions.
Is it David Chandler?
Yes. You know, it's a sad thing. I've been told he's famous, but I... whatever. Different fields. So, a simple explanation is available, though, when you look at what you're actually building. If you're looking at assembly, as you add subunits, you begin to close the capsid. So the early subunits, you're only forming 1 or 2 interactions. Though there's some bumps up and down. You're constantly forming something with more and more bonds. And that last step, the second to last step, you put a subunit in. I have pentameric subunits for my 12-mer. You're forming 4 bonds. Put in the last one, you form 5 bonds. It's the most stable thing you can have. However, when you try taking these apart, the first thing you have to do is take out a piece with 5 bonds. It's much easier, even when the capsid is globally unstable, it's much easier for that subunit to fall back in than for it to continue falling apart. The kinetic barrier is through the roof, and the energetic barrier is through the roof. And if by chance you can get that first one out, taking the second one out is no piece of cake either, at least from the perspective of someone trying to dissociate a capsid. After you have a few out, it falls downhill. When you actually do the simulations for this, you see the concentration of capsid actually oscillates a couple times before it finishes falling apart. And that said, let's see. So we can just say that built into the shape of the capsid, we have hysteresis as a kinetic effect, and it derives from capsid closure.
If you have something like this in forward direction, you have to, in the first few things you put together, you also have a lot of excess area of line tension.
Mm-hmm.
You started with something that really had excess area.
Yeah.
So you always go, you're going downhill, going forward. But you do still have
there's still a little bit of a hump on the downhill.
Well, you start with lots of empty, also boundaries, so when you put them together.
As each one assembles, you have more and more bonds formed per subunit, or less and less line tension per subunit. Built into the simulation are a number of cheats, or a number of assumptions that simplify my life and may or may not be realistic. And one is that the forward direction is pretty well constant throughout. And the backward direction just depends on how many bonds to break. So in that first, the first formation where you're only forming one bond, that's the one point where you have a lot of reverse reactions happening. But you also form an awful lot of them early on because you have so much free dimer.
So you're going to explain, I mean, this is all reasonable, why then it's equilibrium? Because you have, initially we're talking about equilibrium and dimers, and you don't have equilibrium.
This way, you know, if you were willing to wait forever and ever, you would get to equilibrium in the dissociation reaction. But
you don't.
But I'm not, and so experimentally.
Why are your initial curves that you are showing, which is the same series, by equilibrium curves?
So, over here, the forward reaction actually gets to equilibrium pretty quickly, it in a very reasonable time frame. So this sort of a curve, and this is the amount of caps that is done in mass fraction, which is why it's curving instead of just going straight up. But this sort of curve can be calculated from the strength of the bonds or as a product of the simulations. But microscopically, I see what your question is. Microscopically, each one of these is going backwards and forwards. And if you were to take, if you were to make one of these reactions one way, you would continue sucking material all the way into capsid. You would never have any pseudocritical concentration at all. It would just go down to zero. And until it went down to zero, you would have a varying concentration of free subunit.
But on your time scale, it's effectively bonded.
On my time scale, it's effectively irreversible.
So why is it equilibrium?
Because on my time scale, the dissociation is effectively reversible. The forward reaction does it because these component reactions are in fact reversible, all of them.
Except for the last one, it's not.
Well, no, even microscopically, even this last one is. But what's going to happen is we're going to eventually get to the right amount of capsid dictated by an equilibrium value. And by that point, the concentrations of all intermediates is going to fade to their steady state, which is very small. And we're not going to be able to drive this reaction backwards, but we've already reached as far as it's going to go.
The time it takes the forward reaction to reach that situation is the same as the time it would take in the reverse reaction to see it actually.
The asymptotically, the forward reaction hits. No.
Be in equilibrium.
Asymptotically, that forward reaction. It comes very, very close to equilibrium in a very short time. That reverse reaction has that huge barrier in the first steps. It will reach the same equilibrium, but it will take, it's basically we've created a huge kinetic barrier by having these thermodynamically stable intermediates. Yes?
At every step in this set of chemical reactions, did you impose detailed balance, that forward ratio forward over backwards rate minus the energy difference between the two states?
Correct. At every step, the forward reaction, basically the way the reactions were calculated in my simple-minded way is that I say the equilibrium constant for an individual reaction is the forward reaction rate divided by the backward reaction rate. I've imposed a constant forward rate. The equilibrium constant is a function of the number of bonds in any statistical terms. And therefore, the backward rate is just the forward rate divided by the equilibrium constant. I'm a very simple man.
No, that's fine. So that's fine. So the whole reaction obeys detailed balance from the beginning to the end.
Yep. Yes. And
even for the last step, you do allow that one of the pentamers will pop out, even though it has to break five.
Absolutely. It is built in there, and you can see when you do the reverse reaction, you do get some dissociation. And what's fun is that initially, when you take a close look at the simulations for the reverse reaction, you get many capsids losing a few pentamers, So you see a significant drop in capsid, an observable drop in capsid concentration. But as the concentration of free subunits goes up, then you suddenly start reassembling capsids with this excess of pentamers. So you wind up with that neat little oscillation. Which had me running around trying to show people who had no understanding of what I was showing them. And so, again, so this is fun with physical chemistry, but and saying something about the importance of the shape of a capsid and the importance of a closed structure. But it becomes equally important to relate it back to biology. So the neat things are, because of this hysteresis, capsids are stable under conditions that won't support assembly, and the capsids will persist in inhospitable environments. From a biological perspective, it means that if you have a virus that actually has to uncoat as part of its life cycle, you will need a catalyst to drive uncoating. You will need some sort of a biological can opener. And you can see this in a number of cases. With hepatitis B, suddenly the virus falls apart when it's in the portal to the nucleus. With something like poliovirus, which doesn't fall apart, when the receptor binds, suddenly it undergoes this huge conformational change and starts spitting out its nucleic acid. So you can think of these things as a molecular mousetraps waiting to get set off. And so, from a simple model, we get a pseudocritical concentration, we get weak local interactions, we get intermediates that are transient at best and rare at equilibrium, we get hysteresis, and all of these match up with molecular dynamic simulations, both from David Chandler and from Russell Schwartz. And these results imply there's some mechanism for regulating assembly and some mechanism for regulating dissociation. And what I'll do is I'll leave this up without any comment, and after this, after this we go into hepatitis B, so that would be a great time for a break. The only point in this is that three different systems have been studied in some detail, and what we see is that three different, notably different assembly mechanisms are involved. But when you try comparing these to the structures that are involved, they begin to make sense. HBV seems to have a nucleus of a trimer of dimers, CCMV, a pentamer plus one of dimers, HPV11, a dimer of pentamers. But I'm going to now blow by that one and talk about hepatitis B assembly and taking advantage of assembly, what we know about assembly, to investigate a small molecule that has potential to be an antiviral. So Hep B, in an infected cell, Hep B starts off, you can consider the Hep B life cycle starting off with a covalently closed circular DNA, basically a plasmid sitting in the nucleus. And from that plasmid, you get subgenomic RNAs in two forms of the full-length mRNA. Subgenomics code the surface protein that goes on to be the vaccine. Full-length RNA, depending on whether or not you have a couple bases, is either used as an mRNA or it's the pregenomic RNA. And pregenomic RNA, the mRNA, you get core protein and viral reverse transcriptase. The pregenomic RNA binds to the reverse transcriptase and is encapsulated by the core protein to form predominantly T=4 particles made of 120 dimers of the core or capsid protein. And you have these RNA-filled cores. These are not infectious. Once the thing is assembled, the reverse transcriptase becomes active. You can get reverse transcriptase to do the first couple of bases, convert the first couple of bases into DNA, but it won't go beyond that. Reverse transcription is a pretty complicated process, and you think the you get the impression the nucleic acid is doing gymnastics within the capsid. But you wind up with partially double-stranded DNA genome in an infectious core. These cores can then either be exported from the cell by the endoplasmic reticulum. So
the reverse transcriptase works on what's inside the capsid.
Right.
So it gets into the capsid.
It's packaged along with the RNA.
Oh, okay. It's packaged with the RNA. Mm-hmm. Okay.
By that time, are tails of proteins already cut, like in HIV virus?
Oh, so it's a very different life cycle. We don't have any sort of proteolytic maturation with hepatitis B. But what we do get is phosphorylation of those tails. And if it's phosphorylated, it gets sent back to the nucleus. And when it goes back to the nucleus, it's following the same path that an infection follows. And it's a way of maintaining the infection. So otherwise, this plasmid will eventually get spit out of the nucleus, it's no longer an infected cell. So this is a picture of the virus life cycle. Lots of individual steps along the way.
What's the fraction of that step? I mean, at this bifurcation here, is it?
Nobody knows, as far as I know.
It's random somehow.
It's essentially random. I don't know what the signal is for phosphorylation, but once you are phosphorylated, you tend to go back. The virus goes to the nucleus.
But it's significant numbers along each branch.
Yes, and depending on the mutant, you might change which way things branch.
You said that the plasmid DNA was spit out of the nucleus. What do you mean by that?
Is somehow eliminated, and I have no idea of the mechanism. So I hope that clarified it.
If you prevent transport back into the nucleus, then you're saying the cell ultimately becomes, quote, uninfected.
Yes, and it can be months before that plasmid clears.
And is the whole virus going to stick into the nucleus?
No. All right. So the whole virus, when it is secreted, will get this coat. When it enters the cell, it will lose this coat by an unknown mechanism, probably either fusion to the membrane or going into and being endocytosed and then fusing with that membrane and getting into the cytoplasm. This whole virus is just small enough to enter the nuclear pore, and the whole thing will fit into the nuclear pore. If it's cross-linked somehow, it just gets stuck there. If it's not cross-linked, it will uncoat, and you wind up with protein and the viral DNA entering the nucleus. And that viral DNA has a gap in it, that gap is filled, and you have the plasmid.
So once it's in the nucleus, this virus decomposes and releases its...
It seems to decompose. Its dissociation is linked to entering the nucleus itself. So it's possible the nuclear pore is acting as that molecular can opener I described earlier. So both association and dissociation are critical. So Hep B is a huge public health issue, especially in Southern Asia. But there's more than 350 million chronic infections, and it's probably a great underestimate. It is a major cause of cirrhosis, and it is the leading cause of liver cancer worldwide. And the assembly of the virus is required for RNA packaging. It's required for DNA synthesis. It's required for intracellular trafficking, export from the host, and import into the nucleus. So assembly is critical. It should be a great target for antivirals. Pharmaceutical companies, to make another generalization, pharmaceutical companies don't like to do anything that another pharmaceutical company hasn't already done. And this causes an interesting barrier to novelty. So the folks at Bayer, so I'm going to tell you about HAP1. And this is the punchline to the whole story, and I'll go through the whole story and we'll hit each point here. HAP1 is a molecule that was discovered by Bayer in Germany, and Bayer has since closed this program and in fact closed their whole infectious disease program. So there's a new startup company in Germany that now owns the rights to these particular molecules. But HAP1 speeds up virus assembly. It destabilizes five folds in the capsids. It stabilizes six folds, so you can well imagine what that's going to do. And what we find is that HAP stabilizes certain interactions within a dimer, we've determined the structure of a HAP1 Hep B complex. You see that HAP1 actually does flatten the six folds, and it puckers the five folds. So let's start off. This is to assure you that we know something about Hep B assembly in vitro. On the left, we have real data. This is light scattering data that's been normalized to the mass fraction of capsid. We have different concentrations of protein from 4 to about 10 micromolar capsid protein, 0.3 molar sodium chloride, 25 degrees. And at low concentrations, you can see the lag phase. The lag becomes shorter, assembly becomes steeper. And without going into any of the details, kinetic analysis suggests that the limiting step in this reaction is formation of a trimer of dimers. And this is kind of nice because you can see trimers and dimers all over this capsid over here. And one way of testing this, at least to a first approximation, is to build a model out of Hep B-like subunits, these rectangles. See it with pointer. And slow step to form a nucleus, and then rapid assembly to form a 30 subunit capsid. And another gross oversimplification in this model is there's a single determinate pathway rather than the numerous possible pathways, many of which are followed. And again, you see a bit of a lag phase. And basically, you see the same sort of kinetics over here. Qualitatively similar, quantitatively, there are differences. The association energy here is experimentally determined, and these rates are just best estimates, trying to get the most colorful fit.
You're asking me to describe the question, but Chuck said something before this. Bell enough. Why are people choosing these high salt concentrations?
People is me.
0.3, there was a 0.7, yeah.
Experimental convenience. 0.15 works just fine, but it requires huge amounts of protein, and things are slow. So in order to get this to work in 0.3, I'm using 4 to 10 micromolar protein, and we do a lot of reactions. To do it with 0.15 molar sodium chloride, I'd have to have 15 to 30 micromolar protein, and instead of waiting 10 minutes, we'd have to wait realistically 30 minutes to an hour to see a similar range of assembly.
But why does the salt do that?
This is a fun question. One possibility is that it's speeding up the rates, but one of the important things it's doing is by stabilizing that interaction energy, it's stabilizing the intermediates, so you have a higher concentration of intermediates, which allows the whole reaction to go forward faster.
Do you have a mechanism by which it stabilizes?
Yes, but it's not well developed. What I feel is happening is that we have this assembly inactive state and an assembly active state. So if we have an inactive state, small molecules should be able to drive it to the active state and we go forward. My notion is that salt is destabilizing the inactive state. More salt, more inactive, more active state. And so, taken by itself, that's an awful thin argument. However, if we use micromolar concentrations of zinc, we dramatically accelerate assembly. So much so that we tend to form kinetic traps. And the whole story with HAP1, if we have an inactive state, we should be able to find an allosteric activator. And the point I'm going to make with HAP1 is that HAP1 is a synthetic allosteric activator that helps push the assembly reaction forward.
I thought salt screens the tails.
There are no tails here.
No tails at all?
Nope. We've bobbed them, yes. So there's no big clusters of charge in the assembled capsid. In fact, the only charge interactions we see in the assembled capsid are some attractive salt bridges formed between dimers and within a dimer.
Yes. But they're almost neutral. Each dimer is
hard. Dimers have a overall slight negative charge, so we could run them into a gel, as a for instance. But
I was wondering about your nucleation rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me put it this way. I could have the elongation rate change over orders of magnitude with very modest changes in the shape of these curves. But the 70, the nucleation rate is really the dominant factor in scaling these curves. So, while it, you know, is it slow, is it fast? It's actually probably not too far from right. So, it's a timer built into this. So Bayer came up with this compound when they were just doing a screen of small molecules that affected Hep B production in tissue culture, and then discovered that Hep decreased production of virus in a capsid-dependent manner. They published in Science. I wrote them, asked for some of this. They wrote me back saying no, because they were involved in negotiations or whatever. So M.G. Finn synthesized this guy for me. It differs by not having these fluorines, and we have a racemic mixture around that chiral center. So only about half the molecules are actually active. First question, does HAP1 affect assembly at all? So this is an answer to your question, Adrian, why were we using high salt? Here we have assembly of 10 micromolar capsid protein at 37 degrees, where the pseudocritical concentration is just below 10 micromolar. In the absence of any HAP1, we had 150 millimolar sodium chloride over here, and we see this feeble amount of assembling. But we do see assembling. It's just if I want to do a lot of experiments, it's not a convenient set of conditions. As we add more and more HAP1, what you see is that the amount of light scattering increases dramatically. So to a first approximation, we're certainly getting more assembly, though we don't know of what. Over here, it's the sort of kinetics that I sort of expect. But over here, the amount of light scattering we're getting is happening so fast, and there's so much of it. I have to be convinced that what we're getting isn't capsid anymore.
What's actually done at 100 seconds?
At 100 seconds over here, the salt was added. That's when the protein and HAP were pre-incubated for 20 minutes. You get a baseline, and at 100 seconds, the ionic strength was increased to 150 millimolar.
So that's actually the zero in the sense of this.
Yes. So, at low concentrations of HAP, first off, at zero HAP, this is a uranyl acetate stained electron micrograph, and you can see that in the absence of HAP, we're getting nice, neat capsids. Most are the larger 340 angstrom diameter particles, and a few are the smaller 300 angstrom diameter T=3 particles. As we start adding HAP at low concentrations, the majority of particles still look pretty reasonable. 5 micromolar protein, 5 micromolar HAPs, things start going bad. At higher, when we have... This is 24 hours after initiating assembly, yeah. In fact, if we take a look at short times, what we see is that we do have a substantial concentration of intermediates in the presence of HAP, and that's probably why we have that very rapid rise in light scatter. So we do get intermediates at inconvenient times. High concentrations of HAP. You can see this thing is in the ballpark of 1,000 angstroms long. It is definitely not spherical. It's definitely not something that is very virus-like. Though on a local level, you actually have a hexagonal. It turns out it's actually a hexagonal grid of hexagonal arrangement of capsid protein. And here, higher and higher HAP. What you just see is more of these large guys, and they are may or may not be closed, but they appear to be roughly tubular, sometimes with closed ends, sometimes not.
Are you seeing these hexagonal, or did you see that somewhere?
With larger ones, we could do calculate a Fourier transform and get a nice hexagonal pattern, and the spacing of peaks in that pattern correspond to the length of a dimer. So it's a P3 or a lowercase p, P3 or P6 planar arrangement.
Those are like tubes, I'm not sure how to
make those. Okay, so this is actually some of the discussion yesterday. Why are the sides of these white? Well, it's like looking down a cylinder. The interior is a little dark because stain has accumulated there. So when you see a white edge, it means you have a greater thickness of protein that you're looking through. So this is roughly sort of a conical shape. If you just had a sheet, this is urine acetate. If you had a sheet that was petering out, you probably wouldn't see a sharp edge to it. These are regular capsids. These are misassembled. This is a case of misdirected assembly, where the HAP1 seems to be is the factor that has led to misdirection.
But they're still capsids. They're just bigger capsids.
I don't know if you could call them capsids anymore. I'm not sure what to call them. They're certainly polymers, malformed polymers of the capsid protein.
You think the word capsid should be used only for something the virus intended?
In this case, yes.
Are they kind of closed objects?
This one certainly doesn't look closed. This one does. Most of the ones in here don't. The larger they are, the more likely you are to have things that seem to peter out without closure.
Do you see a lot of clones?
No.
This is exceptional, number
10? This is the one we saw.
So I can't ask you about quantization of clone angles, right?
That's it. the error bars are great.
I have a question.
This is also our only smiley face.
About you said you had this lattice constant of the P6 or whatever,
yeah.
A triangle of a lattice. So is that in agreement with the size of the triangles on the T3 and T4?
It's an agreement with the size of the dimer. The unit cell dimension for the P3 lattice is approximately the length of a capsid protein dimer.
But could the same thing be said for the triangles on the Casper-Klug capsids?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay.
So you're not accumulating stain in the 10 micromolar in cell?
Not particularly. I mean, it depends on the particular day, and it's awful iffy.
Okay, so there's no significance to there not being any in that particular picture?
Not that I know of.
Does light scattering reassure you that you're getting these kinds of aggregations?
Light scattering just assures me that I'm having some sort of aggregation, and in fact that I was getting so much aggregation sort of indicates that it's unlikely to be capsid. Even if it were 100% assembling, well, first off, that would be remarkably fast assembly, but there's so much of it so fast, I couldn't imagine that it being capsid. I didn't really, when we first did these experiments, I didn't really envision that HAP1 would stabilize capsids, but I'll show you it does. Or stabilizes assembly.
I had my own aberrant thought to go with the aberrant part, that some years ago, Peter Rand and I had read a paper about urine acetate staining of lipid bilayers, and with X-ray diffraction, we looked to see what happened to the dimensions of the lipid bilayer when there was one urinal acetate for every 30 lipid molecules, and it dramatically changed the packing of the lipids.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you did this with, it sounds really weird, but if you did it with different levels of urinal acetate,
when you get this much polymorphism, it means it's really sensitive to what's going on around it.
Well, we've been doing urinyl acetate for years
yeah.
in the absence
yeah,
of
half. Yeah, those are well behaved, so you don't worry so much.
And this sample scatters a huge amount of light compared to this sample.
Yeah.
So that's a piece of it. We've tried a number of other stains, but I don't think with HAP. So, in fact, however, it's kind of fun. If we take particles assembled in the presence of HAP and run them over size exclusion column, you see the whole peak shift towards the void. So another thing saying they're bigger. And an experiment I'll show you later, when you take pre-assembled capsids and add HAP, we wind up creating a new peak shifted to the void.
What does your light scattering look like blown up at short times?
I would love to give you an answer for that. We haven't looked at it in sufficient detail. What you can see over here at lower HAP concentrations, you do see some sort of a sigmoidal shape. I'm not sure that that's real. I like to think that it is. At the higher concentrations, you see such an increase in light scattering. These are manually mixed, and you just can't see the short times. We haven't tried these in a stop flow instrument, because one of the reasons HAP1 is not a drug is that HAP1 is an incredibly sticky, greasy molecule. It forms micelles given enough time. So I'm loath to put it in a stop flow instrument where removing it from the tubes might be difficult.
You haven't tried the PC on
it? Oh, yes, we have. For what it's worth, HAP1 will stick to the packing, but it will also stick with the capsid protein. Baer determined that for Bay 41-4109, the KD is about 50 nanomolar, so it binds quite nicely. But these particles from here to here run over a size exclusion column, a GPC column, run just like normal capsids. These particles have the peak shifted to higher molecular weight.
And broadened.
But
you don't have, I don't see several
peaks. No. So that's for assembly reactions. So one of the things about HAP1, so we see that in an assembly reaction, we like to form hexagonal patterns, and we see that we get much more assembly. So one of the questions is, what is this going to do to preformed capsids? And so here's an example of behavior of capsids under different or assembly under different conditions. If we take dimer on ice, it stays dimer blue. This is all determined by size exclusion chromatography. As we put conditions that stabilize assembly, we get more capsid and less dimer. Nothing too unusual. If we take these exact samples and add HAP1 and wait 24 hours, we come up with a new peak in the size exclusion experiments. And this is shifted to higher molecular weight. We see that dimer concentrations drop, sometimes precipitous, sometimes to undetectable. And we're actually ripping capsids apart to form something larger. And the real surprise here was over here. This was actually a control experiment, because here we know that dimer never, ever, ever assembles. Unfortunately, almost all of it did assemble and moved into something that came out in the void volume. And I probably should have included the figure here. But this stuff here in electron micrographs turned out to form truly huge complexes, things that were 1,500 angstroms in one dimension and 1,000 angstroms in another. And that's the material that we were able to do optical Fourier transforms on. But in every case here, we see that it's forming really large complexes. So it really seems that HAP is doing a lot to stabilize.
Why doesn't it work better on low temperature?
Huh?
Why doesn't it work better on low temperature?
I think it might be a function of more starting material. I, I don't know the answer. I'm taking a guess at that. But here we have a huge amount of dimer, and it doesn't have to take any capsid apart. If we allow these to sit longer, we get less capsid and more non-capsid polymer. So, I'm sorry, go on.
So is your, maybe this is what you're saying just now, but I guess I still haven't, is your picture that HAP1 acts as an enzyme, that it, or is it, it's, or that it's precipitated within, it's incorporated into these complexes?
So over here, what I'll suggest is that, first off, HAP1 is stabilizing a non-capsid structure, but, and so that's why we get this, but it's also destabilizing capsids. And so by destabilizing capsids, part of that hysteresis phenomena is that it's easier for a subunit to fall back in. Well, if we had a way of removing subunits from the reaction, we could alleviate a huge amount of that, maybe all of that hysteresis. And HAP1 seems to be doing it. It's acting like a molecular can opener. It's removing subunits from the reaction mixture and putting them into a different pool. So we know that HAP1 enhances assembly, speeds it up, and that excess HAP has a radical effect on morphology. Since high HAP favors assembly of hexamers, we can say that delta G for hexamer formation is stronger. And we know that low HAP enhances rate but not the extent of assembly, so in the presence of low HAP, free energy for capsids is approximately the same as in its absence. So we can now, if we can say that capsid stability is a function of forming 5-folds and 6-folds, we can then deduce that if the 6-folds are stronger, then the 5-folds have to be weaker. So something nice and simple, nice prediction based on solution studies. And you folks may not have much problem with it, but when you say this to biologists, they say, prove it. So we co-crystallized. So the guy who did the HAP work was Stephen Strape, postdoc in my lab, who's now going on to a faculty position in Mississippi. Another postdoc, Christina Born, co-crystallized HAP with capsid protein, or rather with capsids. We used two versions of the capsid protein, both lacking the native cysteines simply because it crystallizes a whole lot better. One has a C-terminal cysteine and can form intramolecular crosslinks. What we find out is in the absence of HAP, we get a unit cell that looks like this. And I just want to point out in the B dimension is actually smaller than the diameter of the capsid. So when you look at a packing diagram, you see that the spikes on the capsids are interdigitating. Neat little crystal contact. In the presence of HAP, we come up with the same space group and some similarities in the dimensions, but now that B dimension is much larger. Clearly, we have some sort of different packing. In fact, the whole molecule is packed differently. It's rotated about 20 degrees from here to here. So we have completely different constellation packing contacts. And to cut to the chase, here's what we have here is two models with density over them, but I want to start off on this as a sort of a map of what's happening. Here we have image reconstruction of a HepB capsid. We have an AB dimer and a CD dimer, two classes of dimer. TEQ4 capsid has four different proteins forming the asymmetric unit. We just lump them together as dimers. Now in this X-ray, a crystallographic density. We have the density in the absence of HAP in green, in the presence of HAP in magenta. If you look at this AB subunit over here, it's going from a 5-fold to a quasi-6-fold, you don't see any of the green density. It's as if the density for the A subunit and the B subunit in the presence of HAP are at a higher elevation, completely obscuring the green density. Over here we have a CD subunit. We see these nice striations across them. It's as if it's either twisted or shifted over somehow. Now, the reason I'm showing density rather than going straight to models is because we have 4 angstrom resolution in the absence of HAP, which is not great, but for a virus with 60-fold non-crystallographic symmetry averaging, is it gives you a respectable density map. In the presence of hapware at 5 angstroms, which is not a pleasing, it's not a pleasing state to be, but we can still trace the chain and see some important differences along the way. We can also, because of that non-crystallographic symmetry, do a fair job of minimizing a model into that density. And when we compare an AB dimer in the presence of HAP, in the absence of HAP, and try to align them as best we can, we actually see there's next to no difference between them. The RMSD for C alphas is one angstrom, which is as good as we could expect at this resolution if they were absolutely identical. For the CD dimer, it's pretty much the same. And the only differences you see are over here and over here, and those are not reliable differences. So tertiary structure is identical. The difference shows up in the quaternary structure, the arrangement of the subunits in the context of the capsid. And this is my cheesy schematic. Thin lines are in the absence of HAP, thick lines are in the presence of HAP. Basically, we've taken our AB, CD asymmetric unit and created a pivot point at the end of the B subunit and tilted the whole thing up slightly. So the A subunit goes up, and the C and D subunits are flopping over.
Is that what you were calling allostery before?
Essentially, this is, actually, this is a, this, that allostery would have to happen in the context of the individual dimer. So this is a quaternary change at a later point. I'm not sure how to fit that into an allosteric, a formal allosteric model.
You don't actually know if inside is really allosteric. So the data don't necessarily substantiate inside the
machine. Well, actually, I'll show you in about 2 slides. Okay. So again, here is that asymmetric unit over here, or similarly, here's another asymmetric unit. A subunit is tilted up by about 3.5 to 4 angstroms. Here's our pivot point in the B subunit. So the whole thing, which hasn't changed compared to the absence of HAP, is tilted up. And that means this CD subunit is now tilted over this way. And you can see that the spikes have moved on over. Because that CD subunit is tilted, we have striations. Because the AB subunit is tilted up, we completely obscure the density for the minus HAP structure. And that was just to show you the an icosahedral asymmetric unit. And so this is the answer to your question. Where's the HAP? So when you take a look at the map with all the density, it's really hard to see an additional blob of density, especially something that is about a 400 Dalton blob in the context of 70 kilodaltons of protein at 5 angstroms resolution. But when you look at our observed at a map using icosahedrally averaged phases, using FOBs, our observed structure factors minus our calculated structure factors, you wind up with one blob of density. Here's a dimer interface, D subunit, C subunit. We see this blob of density right here in the C subunit. It's not present in the A subunit. It's only very weakly present in the B subunit. It's not present in the D subunit. And this, here we see, basically, here's the C terminus, a loop and an alpha helix, another alpha helix over here, and here's our blob of density. In the absence of HAP, helix, 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 and a nice little hydrophobic pocket over here. In the presence of HAP, in magenta, you see the 2FO minus FC density, density with the protein. And in the cyan, you see the FO minus FC density contoured at 15 sigma above background. It's hard to imagine that something that strong is our imagination. It winds up being a very interesting place to put a HAP molecule. First off, this is an extended structure over here that would be expected to be pretty floppy in the absence of assembly. And it's attached to an alpha helix that might be expected to not be particularly tight in place. But you put a hydrophobic molecule here, it's very attractive to imagine that this is filling a plug and helping to stabilize a dimer into a more capsid-like conformation. When you look at it in the context of the structure, HAP is right here, right here. Here's that asymmetric unit that moves as a rigid block. Well, HAP is right at the gap between two asymmetric units. And you can see what it's doing, one way of envisioning what it's doing is it's pushing the C subunit in this direction, the D subunit in this direction, causing this tilt over here and buckling the fivefold outward. So it really makes structural sense in terms of the quaternary changes we're seeing. And if we have a trimer of dimers nucleating assembly, well, suddenly we have a HAP at each vertex at those trimer of dimers. No, it's a seductive observation, not a convincing observation, but it provides another possible mechanism for HAP to have a role in assembly kinetics. And this is actually, another way of envisioning this is each of our icosahedral asymmetric units is a nice, neat triangle. Here at the B subunit, we have a pivot point. The A subunits are poking out. And the end result is that this guy here, the quasi-sixfold is actually flatter, and these things pucker out. So, what does HAP do? It speeds up assembly, it destabilizes fivefolds, and it stabilizes sixfolds. We know that from solution studies. It appears to stabilize an assembly active form by filling in a hydrophobic pocket near that relatively floppy C-terminus. And this could be an allosteric mechanism for assembly, simply by favoring one conformation over a less ordered one. It flattens the six volts by putting a burr between the C and D subunits. And because it's flattened that interaction and it hasn't done anything to the interaction between B subunits and the C subunit, oops, supposed to have another line there, it mechanically is forcing the A subunit up, puckering out the fivefold and weakening the fivefold. So the structure is doing a wonderful job of confirming and rationalizing the mechanism for the solution studies. So bottom lines, there's wonderful, so thus far we've seen a wonderful synergism between assembly studies, or we've been working on a synergism between assembly studies and models. The models have to actually, are one model does not fit all. You have to have the model fit the biology, and that's going to change from system to system, but you can make some neat generalizations. And my short list of them is that the contact energy between subunits in a capsid should be really weak, otherwise you're going to get kinetic traps, but you're also expending a lot of energy or expending a lot of effort to make something real stable. In fact, stabilizing capsids is another antiviral approach that's taken with rhinovirus, where there's a drug that Plecanoril, which decreases your time of a common cold from about 6 days to about 2 or 3 days. Unfortunately, also wipes out the efficacy of birth control pills, which seems to. you hadn't heard that? So it that seems to be part of the reason that was not approved by the FDA. But it also does work on polio, so if that should become a big problem. Half the population. It will work on all the population, but the half the population really need big warnings on the bottles. Dissociation displays hysteresis. That's a function of capsid closure. And an implication is that if you have capsids with defects, not just defects forming fivefolds, but more substantial structural defects, you're going to erase that hysteresis. It appears that Hep B assembly is allosterically regulated. We've shown that with, at least on a synthetic level, we've shown that with HAP1, we've shown that with zinc. We have a couple other molecules in the lab that seem to have pretty dramatic effects, either inhibiting assembly or enhancing it. So that seems to be a common theme, and it makes sense that it should be a common theme, though not in all viruses, in many other viruses. Because there is some level of allostery, means we can take advantage of that by having drugs that favor one conformation or another. And the bottom line, from my perspective, is that a clear understanding of assembly is made possible by credible models and model-based predictions. And so there's a wonderful opportunity for physicists and biologists to actually agree. But I doubt anyone will use that. And that said, the guys who did the work, Christina Bourne did the crystallography, Stephen Stray did the solution studies with HAP. This guy you'll hear about as I start working with a full-length protein. Santanu and Jennifer work on CCMV, and other guys are doing other things. Carol Teschke's lab does the P22 work, and the CCMV reconstructions were done with Jack. And the drugs from MG. So thanks very much, guys.
So there are trees in Oklahoma.